talk to Lynn at all?
Just begin. I talked to him this morning. He said he's ready.
Yeah, so once he's on, Scott, just tell him, go ahead and go.
Okay.
And then click.
Hi. Hi, Lynn. You ready? Okay.
Hello. We're all hooked up. I think they're getting their final connection to the PA system up there. Hope they didn't cut us off.
No, well, but you never know.
Yep.
Everything is possible.
Tell them we're set.
Hey, Lynn. We're all set for you. We're all set for you. Okay.
Speak loudly.
Yes.
Okay. So say when.
When?
Say the magic word.
When?
Okay. Well, this is a very interesting time of your life and mine. For example, we have a pattern of things which is indicative. A case in Germany, in Bavaria, where we made a comparison to shocked for some of the present policies. And somebody tried to officially get nasty about the fact that we mentioned shocked as a precedent for what is actually going on today. In France, we have a case with Eric, also implicating our dear friend Pierre, Jacques, rather. And there also something has done the same thing. In the United States, a similar thing. Now, we actually have live Nazis running around all over the place in government, in the Democratic Party, and elsewhere. They don't always call themselves Nazis, but their pedigree is that. That is, they is that, you know, I've gone through this again and again and again and tried to make it absolutely clear that this long history of from the 18th century, when the British East India Company under Shelburne set into operation in France, an operation called the Martinists, out of which came the French Revolution, came Napoleon Bonaparte, then came the Sinarchists between 1918 and 1945, who produced all of the international Nazi operation, including the Spanish. Franco was a Nazi. That is, he was a junior Spanish-speaking division of the Nazi Party. And in Mexico, the Nazis directly created a party of Hispanidad, with under various names, including the PAN, which we have this guy, Fernando Quijano, joined under the direction of a Nazi, but in concert with an American, Nestor Sanchez, who was tied to the section of the CIA, which was running death squads in Central America. So, actually, in spirit, is a Nazi. Fernando is, by adoption, a Nazi. So they're all over the place. We're in a period in which, like the period 1918 to 1945, in which the Nazi system was dominating the all of Western and Central Europe. It was under the Nazis, really. But it was under the Sinarchist International, which cleared the Nazis. And when Hitler died, the Sinarchist International continued. And they kept many of their assets from the Nazi SS and SD system in it, including the General Wolf of the SS in Italy, whom the Italian terrorist organization still existing today came. So this thing continued. Now we've come to a time in which the present world system is disintegrating. Actually, we're in the last phase. Where the official financial collapse occurs, we don't know it, but it will be soon. But now we're in the doom of the existing world monetary financial system. Much worse than in the period 1918 through 1933. But it's the same general idea, is that what happened over the post-war period, you had Truman, who was effectively a protector of that section of the Nazi system, which was brought inside the Allied system again through these banker networks. That was his policies for that. Truman had essentially the policies which are followed by Cheney today. So the Democratic Party had its Nazis, too. As a matter of fact, the head of the Democratic National Committee in 1932, John Raskob, who was a guy who was involved in a plot against the President of the United States and was Roosevelt's opponent for the nomination, just as McAuliffe is my opponent. And these guys are all either fools who work for Nazis or Nazis, at least in principle. So that's the problem. That's why people are so sensitive when you make a comparison with a policy now with the same policy which was pushed under different auspices by the Nazis then. We've come full cycle. The Nazi threat is back. It is sitting in the vice president's chair and similar kinds of place, and of course the attorney general's chair. So we still have this problem, and people are very sensitive about it. Now, as you probably have noticed, I have declared open warfare in various degrees on these Nazis. We've done it with the series of the Beastman reports, which are documentation of this. Will Wirtz has taken facts like a blunt instrument and beaten some Mexicans and others half to death who were part of the Nazi system. And we'll do more. I've exposed Fernando, for example, who is an agent of the Nazis, that is of the this crowd in Spain, who actually are a continuation of the Nazis, exposed him as a security risk to the United States, and he is. He is also a broken fool, a coward, who was out of fear, trembling, joined these guys, and became their agent. But nonetheless, being an agent of them, he is a part of a security risk to the United States. He typifies those elements which are being deployed under the so-called Huntington thesis to get a conflict between Hispanic Americans and others, Anglos, so-called. And this is the kind of security risk they represent. They are capable, under their cover, of launching actual, or being a cover for actual terrorist acts against the United States, of the type that are being mooted in Homeland Security and by the currently acting head of the CIA now. Is there a security risk to the United States? Yes. Where does it come from? It comes from the same people who are behind Hitler. That is the same banking network which is supporting the governor of California, Schwarzenegger, who represents a part of the same thing. This is George Shultz. And remember that Schwarzenegger was part of the Enron operation. He was a participant in it through his financial operations. And if one wants to say, who robbed California? Well, Schwarzenegger is still there. Working for George Shultz still. So this problem is here. It's a real problem, and we're out to defeat it. Now, where do we stand? We have several things going on. First, as I've emphasized, you're not going to stop this thing outside the United States. We can find help from outside the United States to stop this problem, as Roosevelt did, but in his time, when he against the Nazis. But we're not going to sit back and find that somebody from abroad, from Europe, elsewhere, are going to intervene and save our bacon by getting this Nazi threat away from us. We're going to have to do it ourselves. If we do it effectively, if we show leadership, the type that Franklin Roosevelt typified, we will get support from many parts of the world for a U.S. effort in this direction, and we can defeat this problem. We can also overcome and deal with this threatened general collapse of the monetary financial system, the economic system. We can deal with that. But it must come from us. Now, coming from us means what? Well, as I've explained, the way the United States works, which is what most people in universities teaching this stuff don't lie about or just don't know about, the United States has a constitutional system which is different than the constitutional system of any other part of the world today. There was a tendency in that direction with Charles de Gaulle in the creation of the Fifth Republic in France as a true presidential system. And he's had some of the impulses in him at that point, particularly after he'd gone through a whole series of changes in his own life. He had the impulses to do it, to save France and to save civilization. But our system is unique. It's a presidential system, and it's based on a principle. Now, other constitutions in the world do not have a principle, not in the sense of a scientific principle. They have a list of do's and don'ts. It's a patchwork collection, a statement of purpose, then something is like a patchwork quilt. You stitch something in here, you stitch something in there, and this patchwork quilt is called a basic law, national basic law. Some people dignify it by the term constitution. But we're the only country in the world which has a real constitution. And we've had the constitution, in principle, since it was adopted between 1787 and 1789. The same principle was expressed in the notion of the pursuit of happiness by the 1776 Declaration of Independence. This constitution came from Europe. It was created in the United States, but the ideas behind it included things like the 15th century Renaissance, the legacy of Athens, Plato's Athens, Solon's Athens. This was a conscious idea in the framers of our republic. Solon's conception of Athens, Solon's letter in his advancing years to his fellow citizens about how they had, shall we say, screwed up. That was a model. Plato's dialogues were a model for what we did in forming a republic. But it was also a Christian model. It was based on the conception of the general welfare, of what's agape, the same concept which is adopted by the Apostle Paul, but which is already in there in the Republic of Plato and in other parts of the dialogues. So we start with a principle which is in the preamble of our Constitution. Principle of sovereignty against empire. We are sovereign. The principle of the general welfare, which is agape for all of our people. The principle of agape is extended to the responsibility to our posterity. So that a youth movement is actually the future of a nation. Because what an adult generation, or the older adult generation, is doing, the incumbent adult generation, is doing with its youth, is the future of that nation. That's our constitution. Our system of government is based on a presidential system, not a parliamentary system. European systems do not have a true republic. None exists in Europe. European systems are based on the existence of an independent, so-called, central banking system, which actually represents a Venetian-style international financier oligarchy. This oligarchy has veto powers over the financial and related affairs of the nation. And in a time of crisis, those interests move in, as they did in 1918 through 1933, to impose what we call fascist states or similar kinds of states on their nations. We have a principle which Roosevelt expressed, as did Lincoln before him, that in a crisis, a financial crisis, the U.S. executive branch must take the lead under its constitutional powers to protect the people against the buzzards, the vultures, the bankers, which is what Roosevelt did. He saved the financial system. He saved the banks in general. But it was done by the federal government under the authority of the federal government to chiefly the executive branch. And the support for what the executive branch was doing rallied from the Congress over a reluctant, mostly pro-fascist, Supreme Court under Hughes. So this is a system. Now, what we've done, we now have, or we are integral to, is the best way to put it, and we are a spark plug within that, a group in the Congress, around certain committees, around certain figures, which is mobilizing resistance against the fascist regime of Dick Cheney and his stooge, the current president. We have also, significantly, from among the ranks of the retired and other representatives of the professional parts of the executive branch of government, military, intelligence, diplomatic, and so forth, we also have support, not only from people who have served in government, as officials, but those who in universities and otherwise, as me, for example, have advised government, have been a part of the presidency in its function at various times in our past careers. Many of us are now grouping together, more and more of us are coming together, resolved to do our part to save this nation from what threatens it. We have, as I said, we have people from the Congress, that background, no longer in the Congress, but formally, people in the executive branch. That's the core. That's the core under our system of mobilizing our constitutional institutions to defend our nation and to rally our people to the defense of the nation in that way. That's what we're doing. So, at this point, our enemy is essentially anyone who is soft on Nazism, which is the same thing as being soft on those kinds of bankers who are like the Syndicus International bankers who gave us the Nazi similar systems throughout Europe between 1922 and 1945. That's what we're doing. Now, there's a very special feature of this, which I addressed also at the recent webcast this past week, Thursday. The idea of immortality. To have the guts to put your life on the line when that may be necessary for the sake of humanity, if you do not have a sense of immortality, you will find you don't have the guts to do it. This is the Hamlet problem. Hamlet plunged to his death, Shakespeare's Hamlet, plunged to his death in order to get out to free himself from this nagging fear of immortality, as he sums that up in his third act, soliloquy. This is a typical problem. I go through a list of people who are candidates for president or have been presidents or similar kinds of positions, and I find a whole bunch of them are cowards in the sense that Hamlet was a coward, who went in flight forward to death rather than face his anxiety about what lies beyond death. Get it over with. Go to death. Get it over with. Like the guy who charges a machine gun nest, gets shot to pieces because he can't stand the tension of waiting. That sort of thing. Flight forward. That's typical of the situation. So therefore, we don't have, this is called a Christian nation. It's not Christian. Don't kid yourself. It's very hard to find a Christian, especially in the churches. They're Hamlet's at best. They believe in an immortality, a heaven which lies outside the universe someplace. They don't believe in immortality of the individual within the universe. Or like Jeanne d'Arc, or like, as I made the comparison to Martin Luther King. Those of us who fight for something, even at the expenditure of our lives, in order to bring something into being which must be brought into being. Our immortality is expressed by doing that. Just like the immortality of any great discoverer of universal physical principle. They live in what they've contributed to humanity, what is transmitted from their work. They put their life on the line for humanity. And they live still because they are still acting in consequence of the discovery of the similar act that they've made, which is still there vibrating, still giving life to civilization. People lack that. Now, to have an effective youth movement, you have two factors. First of all, you have the fact that, nobody's getting out of this life alive, you know. But you have also a sense among youth that there is no future under a continuation of the present trends, the baby boomer trends. And there has been for the past 4 or 5 years a very sharp cleavage, a new kind of cleavage, not only within the United States, but also within Europe. The cleavage of the young adult generation, that is typified by the 18 to 25 group, and their parents' generation. This is not a difference within the family. It's almost as if it were a different species. Because the old fellows they're not so old really, but they pretend to be. The old fellows are wandering around in dreamland and fantasy land, acting out a fantasy, not facing reality, looking at their comfort, living in a world of entertainment, not reality, fleeing from reality into entertainment, like the ancient Romans or Imperial Rome. Bread and circuses. The bread is shrinking, but the entertainment is increasing. So the problem is, if you're going to you're going to take the job of changing society, it's like fighting a war. You're putting your life on the line. If not physically, at least in principle. Do you have the stamina to stand up to that? Or will you fall by the wayside when the pressure gets too tough? The fears become too great, like Hamlet's fears. The only way you conquer that is to have the sense that you are, in a sense, have access to immortality. And that's, of course, the reason why I emphasize this Gauss 1799 paper, and what's related to that, is to get a sense inside our people of this, as I've described, as a lightning, like a lightning bolt, where suddenly you see the point, in this case made by Gauss against Euler and Lagrange. When you see that, now you know what a universal physical principle really is. And you understand that this is a power in and over the universe. And that by grasping that and building upon that, you can change the world for the better, for coming generations. It gives you a personal sense of the authority of immortality. And that's what we're trying to do. And that's why the youth movement is crucial. We're now going into Boston. Nobody knows what's going to happen up there. On the one side, it's a clown show. But on the other side, some of the people who are participating in the clown show, even people like Kerry and so forth, have a sense that there's something very, very wrong in the present process in the Democratic Party in particular, and in the nation. So it's not decided. Some things seem to be decided. Some people are pushing to say, no, it's closed. The question is settled. It's all over. It's concluded. It's not. But we don't know what's going to happen, because what is going to happen is probably something that nobody thinks is going to happen, including us. So it's like going into war. You're going to a situation. There is going to be a decision. There's going to be a battle somewhere. And things are going to happen. What's going to happen? You don't know. But you know that you're going to do what you can to determine the outcome, whatever turn the situation takes. Now, what we're going to do is, as I said, I'm going to get out soon a platform, which will be an independent platform, for Democrats. I will have that platform circulated in the context of the convention, and also more widely circulated. It'll be an overlap of what is going on with the campaign now. So the campaign will actually continue. We'll go beyond the pre-presidential, pre-nomination campaign to the post-nomination campaign, and we'll do it without skipping a step. We'll still be in there. We'll be doing it. Just be doing it under slightly different auspices, mobilizing the nation, mobilizing around the idea of the presidency, and also concern for the composition of the Congress and various other issues we take up. What we're going to do is we're going to cause the youth movement to emerge as a spearhead of the politics of the Democratic Party, whether they think so or not. That's what we're going to do. And you guys have to have a sense of your immortality. You have to have a sense of history, not from the underside, but from the top side. Looking at it in the long term. And we've got to go in there. We've got to hold our own events in Boston. Whatever happens in the convention, we will do what you people used to call our thing. We'll be there. We will be an interaction with the convention process. Maybe not in the halls of the convention, but in the process around it. We will come out of that as much remembered or more so than the convention itself. Because people may walk away from this convention and discuss, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? Whatever the selections are of the presidential candidates, we are going to shape the environment which will determine what those candidacies mean going into the November elections. That's what we're going to do. And so, therefore, we are now in a time where decisions are made, the great decisions are made, which determine the outcome of history for a long time to come. If you look back, you realize that since 1763, there is a certain continuity in modern European history as extended to larger parts of the planet. It's a continuous process. we've now come to what might be called a millennial crisis point. We're hundreds of years, actually implicitly thousands of years, since the fall of Athens and since the rise of Rome. We've come to a point where there's going to be a change in the course of history. We're either going into a liberation from the kinds of problems which the past events of the previous century have meant, or we're going into a dark age. We are at the crucial point of making that decision. Why? Because we're powerful? No. Because we have this or that? No. Because nobody else is willing to do it. Nobody else is willing to take on the challenge which I posed. We have to do it. And as I saw in the discussions we had this Thursday evening after the webcast event among people who were largely from elected representatives, our discussion, which took a very interesting turn in the process, they understand, or they have an understanding of what we have to do. They understand that a Democratic Party without a real youthfulness, like our youthfulness, not like some bunch of boys carrying tea and coffee or something for flunkies, but our type of youthfulness is the future of the nation, if the nation has a future. So, you got a big job. I'm there as long as I'm alive, but you got a big job before you. Even from a little movement to a big job. That's it. Okay. Back to you.
All right, so whoever has questions, come on up to the front. Just tell Lynn we're waiting for people
so
to come
distortion?
Up.
Distortion? There's a lot of distortion. Okay.
You have to speak up, though. Jack, you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question.
All right. Speak up.
Thank you.
Project your voice.
Speak very clearly.
Hello.
This was in one
Hello.
Of those...
Yeah, we're still connected.
Scott, we're still connected.
Yeah, I'm just waiting.
Okay, sorry.
Go, now.
Hello, Lynn. Hey, this is Jack from Oakland. Oh, should I talk loud? He's saying it's... Sorry. All right, is this good?
Marty? There's nothing I can do about it. You've got to talk loud and you've got to talk clear.
Talk loud, clear, and into the speaker.
Is that good? All right. My question was about, and it's about a foot away from my face. All right, it was how Gauss, when he was actually moving up on the exponentials, like how at 5 is when you had to start using the square root of -1, and he stops at 17. And then also when we were in the Mons Brigades reading the Theaetetus, he stops at 17 too. And then, I mean, when Gauss was dividing the circle, you know, it was a real breakthrough for him when he hit at 17. I'm wondering what is really up with that.
Does not lie within mathematics or interpretation of mathematics. It lies outside mathematics, and it comes into mathematics then as a physical principle which is superimposed upon mathematics. So don't try to find the solution by mathematical or arithmetic manipulation. The point is very simple. It's the way I first made the discovery, which is back when I was about 12, 14 years of age, where I rejected simple, basic geometry as taught in secondary school at that time. Because I recognized from dealing with things like the design of beams, of structural beams, structural steel beams, that these beams were either had holes cut in them, or they had a cross network relationship, so that the total weight of the beam was reduced to an amount where the ratio between the weight of the beam and the strength of the beam were at an optimum. There was, for example, recently, in the recent years, people went over in Paris in the Eiffel Tower, and they took out most of the steel to make the Eiffel Tower stronger by getting rid of the excess metal. Now, from the standpoint of the way geometry was taught then, the assumption was that strength came from material, or the amount of material, as measured in simple solid or plane geometry. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. So therefore, there is no such thing as geometry as commonly taught. It's a fraud. There's only physical geometry, because geometry is an expression of physical processes, not of processes as such. Now, this is the key, for example, in the case of the Euler-Lagrange business. What Euler does, and Lagrange follows that, is says you bring in geometry. That means he means physical geometry. And that's what it, that's what Lagrange's counteroffensive against Gauss was. And there's where the concept lies, the concept of discovery, in understanding this. The problem I find when, and people report this to me rather frequently, that people are trying to say, how do you find from the square root of minus 1, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What you find, what you see then, is that in, when you bring in the question of physical in geometry, and say there has to be a physical geometry, not an abstract geometry. What you're saying is that what you are, geometry as taught is based on a naive interpretation of sense certainty. But then there's something in there which is not directly seen by the senses visibly. It's not a part of visible sense perception, which is what people think geometry is, mistakenly. It's a physical principle which is not seen as a principle by the senses, but is seen by anomalies. For example, the fact that having, in a certain way, having a steel beam stronger in its function because there's holes are cut in it, so to speak, that shows there's a principle which is not obvious from the visible principle. This means that there's something operating beyond vision as a principle which is determining this. This is then the complex domain. This is a recognition that what we see with the senses, or smell or taste or so forth, is not reality, but is the reaction of the sense perception process, which is our organic biological entity, which disappears with us when we die. It goes away. But what we perceive does not go away. It does not lie within the senses. What we perceive is the effect of what does not lie in the senses upon the senses. So our sense perception is a shadow of reality. It is not reality. The way we understand principle is we make discoveries by discovering what lies beyond sense perception, which is a controllable cause. That is by our will, or the equivalent, controllable cause of anomalies which cannot be explained by sense perception. You cannot explain by visual sense perception why a beam is stronger when there's less of it because of the geometric construction of the beam. And that is where the point of discovery lies. That's where the objection, the problems lie. That's where all the problems are here from my youth educational work. All the problems are here about couldn't understand, couldn't break through, why this is unclear. It's always that. It's always trying to look at things from the way it's taught in classrooms. And when you see this, when you understand this, it comes on you, as I have said, like a lightning strike. Just like understanding the way irony functions in classical poetry or in music, the same way. This is the point. This discovery is the discovery that one is human. One is capable of making these kinds of discoveries, of powers whose ontological existence lies beyond sense perception, but powers which we can master and control to change the way the universe responds to us. That's the whole point.
One more. Okay.
Hold it away and speak loudly.
Hey, Lynn.
Loud.
You've
got
to speak loud.
Lynn, I have a question where yesterday I was listening to one of Martin Luther King's speeches on the revolution in Ghana. And throughout the speech, I was just at a point where I was really questioning my whole identity And where I was in this point where we're fighting this revolution, and I was just wondering what the method was by which he was effectively, you know, communicating that idea where you're questioning yourself and your role in this. And I have another question from someone that was too shy to really talk to you about it. But the question was, why don't we actually, you know, when we're looking at this educational system, why don't we effectively, you know, organize the institutions like the Department of Education that actually create a trickle-down effect to the masses of the population, instead of, from what we're doing is going out to the streets and creating a Mange Brigade where it's just, you know, like maybe one person getting the idea and, you know, looking at it from that standpoint.
Okay. Now, but look at what happened. What happened with the freeing of the slaves and the immediate post-war period in the United States, post-Civil War period. Do you see the problem? In this period, you had a policy for the struggle for freedom of persons of African descent. Frederick Douglass typified that. And the idea was you build a movement which is based on the development of the highest level of European civilization's culture. And on the idea that when the individual is educated in that way, as Frederick Douglass himself epitomizes that in a circle, then a person is free in their conception of themselves. That is, they don't think of themselves as being properly slaves or underlings. They think of themselves as being by nature free. Now, when you say, think you're by nature free, and thus have the right to be free, you are going to make yourself free one way or the other. And in the meantime, you're going to have the impact of thinking and acting like a person who senses that they are free in principle upon society. What happened is the great liberals from the northern liberals who came in triumphantly at the end of the Civil War and made reform in education, which is based on the concern, let us not over-educate the freed slaves and their children. Because if we over-educate them, they won't be satisfied with the menial work which we have destined for them to perform. So let's give them third grade or worse levels of education. Let's dumb them down to the point they'll be satisfied with the kind of quasi-slave-like jobs they will continue to do, now free, but otherwise treated almost as if they were still slaves. The educational system today, the institutions of the United States, education, mass media, so forth, are all designed on the same principle that those liberals treated the freed slave population of the United States in the immediate period after the close of the Civil War. These institutions are designed to dumb you down. If you go into those institutions, which are designed to dumb people down, you're going to find yourself in a fight with the institution, a fight which they will tend to win, because they're in control of the premises. Now, if you go into the streets, or effectively into the streets, outside the control of the institutions, and you deal with people, you are now creating the institution. And if you are imparting to those people a sense of what it is to be free by nature in oneself, now you can do something. Whereas if you're trying to influence those people through the institutions, you'll never make it. You'll fail. Because the institutions are designed to produce underlings, not true human beings. When you're on the street and you're really effective in what we do best, when we do it best, you are really effective, much more effective than any official institution, such as the Democratic Party itself is a good example of that. On the first part, Martin Luther King's thing on that is an example of the same thing, the complex domain. As some people try to call it symbolic. It's not symbolic. Symbolism doesn't exist in classical culture. The point is to understand looking at something as if sense position were sense certainty. That is, if what you see is what is there. You have to realize your ability to change the significance of what is apparently there by discovering principles which you can intervene to change the way things work out. And that is the miracle. It's the same idea as going beyond sense certainty to reality.
Morning, Irish. This is CJ.
Loudly.
This is CJ from San Francisco.
Very loud.
Sorry about that. All right. Thanks. I have a question. What would define art in like this century? We've been like discussing that here on and off, and what would define art and why?
First of all, we have a history of art, of classical art, as distinct from romantic and other varieties. Take, for example, the discoveries of Leonardo da Vinci in a change of perspective from vanishing point perspective to circumferential or peripheral perspective. Look at things like version of the grotto, huh? Which there are two sources of light. You can see that clearly. You get into same things with Raphael. You look at Leonardo da Vinci, I mean, by the Rembrandt. Rembrandt, this which I've often referred to, Homer, the bust of Homer, looking at that blind, dumb idiot Aristotle trying to molest Homer's head. On the head of Homer's bust. And you see the irony that gets across in that. So the way, what you do is essentially, is the purpose of studying the difference between classical art and other forms of art is to develop in yourself a sense of what is human as opposed to what is bestial. And the way you approach today is not by trying to go out and make something classical, but you have to have a sense of the classical by studying it. You see, the classical idea is one which has a long history. We generally associate it with Athens, with Greek culture, the classical Greek culture, and we trace the effect of the transmission of the classical form of culture from ancient Greece to modern times. The way to get a classical view is to understand that one must, in a sense, relive highlights of the experience passed on from generation to generation, which give us the classical concept today. We don't start from mud and try to create the classical concept. You have a sense of a historical process of development, which is accessible to us. And by our assimilating that historical process, we now have developed the ability to apply what we have acquired from that historical process and apply it to the present.
Yes, Mr. LaRouche, I was wondering if you happen to have the chance to speak with Mr. John Kerry to, show him some guts or make sure he uses his mind or something.
Aware of my existence. And there are various channels which managed to mediate in his channels and to him. And I get reactions reverberated back to me in the same way. I think that with what happened in Boston in the past days around this Homeland Security operation in Boston around the preparations for the Democratic Convention there, that there has been an expression of, I would say the past 2 days in particular, explosion of disgust since Thursday, because we first got the impressions on Thursday. And, of course, everybody in that circuit either got my webcast, audited it, or had two or three people of their staff auditing it. So they know what I said, and they do react to it. I would say that you would finally find among people like Kerry, there's a great deal of anger about the way the Homeland Security operation is affecting the way the Boston Convention is being prepared. So, and John, of course, is aware of what I've said to some degree or other all the way along. As a matter of fact, he even picked up his 10 million jobs that he was using some time ago with something he picked up directly from me.
Hello, Lynn. Yeah, this is Aaron. I have a question. It's pretty hard to even put it together because, I don't know, I can blame it on being tired, but this is a really emotional question, what you brought up with immortality. Because on thinking about it, it is, you see that it's required that you have to have agape to even take that step. But to get agape, you have to completely, leave yourself and all these personal, like, decisions. Oh, this is my identity. It's like completely beyond all of your already assumed identity situations. And so I was just wondering, how do you strengthen that fight, and how do you also put other people on the path to that fight, or keep them on that path? That's like
basically it's intention, the principle of attention. The sense of immortality has two features to it. As I've emphasized repeatedly, a universal physical principle is not a mathematical description of that principle. That is the smoke trail of the object which passed the principle. So a principle, a universal principle, has an identity. It's like a personality. In other words, when you're looking out sensually, you see a person. You don't see a blur which you interpret mathematically to be a person. You see a person. Because your mind has resolved that this object has an existence as an object, a functional, distinct existence as an object. And you don't understand what it's doing unless you understand it as an object, which is producing effects. Now, then you look at yourself in the same way, and you look at your principles you're operating on in the same way. The key thing here is your sense of identity. The way in which the easiest way in which to, for mass education purposes, to confront people with a sense of what their identity is in these terms of reference, is to go through the reenactment of the original actual discovery of the universal physical principle. Now, what happens is you were associated with that discovery, which is not an abstract discovery. It was a discovery made by a person. So two things are going on. You're trying to understand this experience. When you're told there's a principle there that you should discover an object. You also have indicated to you a personality. Like, for example, we take a discovery like the famous Eureka shriek attributed to Archimedes. And you say, this is Archimedes' principle. Ah, Archimedes! Now you look at the picture, you see the drawing, the representation of Archimedes. Oh, him! He discovered that principle. Now you associate your act of reenacting his act of discovery with his identity in mind. You call it Archimedes' principle. It's not a mathematical principle. It's a concept. It's like the face of a person, and it's personalized. Now you look at yourself in the same way. You now have given yourself, not anal me, a sense of losing yourself in the all, but you now see yourself as a person, an object, person, in principle, who is using a principle to affect the universe. And your sense of immortality is the sense of the radiation of the act of discovery by which you acquire knowledge of that principle upon society around you. That's the sense of immortality. In theology, particularly in the period of the medieval period, there was a discussion of what was called the simultaneity of eternity, that things which are universal live always. They have eternity. The principle does not begin and end in time. The principle is through all time. Therefore, it's eternal. And therefore, you get a sense that if you are a person of principle, acting on principle, that aspect of you as an identity, which is acting upon a universal principle, participates in eternity. And you live always in the past and future, in the simultaneity of eternity. So you don't, in a sense, felt confused as, who am I in this haze of uncertainty? But rather, you have a definite sense of the principles you are associated with, that you're acting for those principles. Those principles that are true have universality. They have universality both in of themselves as universal in character. They also have a historical basis. That is, a whole series of discoveries were made, which leads to a discovery of a certain principle you're using today. So you have a sense of yourself. You have a sense of your obligation to people now long dead who lived before you, who are now, in a sense, living through you, through the principles which have been passed down to you from them. And you are living in the future through what you're doing for the future by the action flowing from you, which expresses a principle.
Who else has a question? Yeah.
Loud and clear.
Hi, Mr. Lin. This is Jojo. I had a question on language. When I was a child, I was taught the complete Spanish language, which contains 29 letters, and they include...
directing towards the microphone, but don't get close to it, and try to elevate your voice.
Okay, hold it a little bit away from you and speak loud.
There you go. That's a good position,
yeah.
Right there.
Go ahead.
You got to speak loud, though. It's simply loud.
Go ahead. Hold it a little.
Okay, Mr. Lin, I have a question. Now, the Spanish language originally contained 29 letters, but when I learned the letters, it contained 29. It contained la che, la eje, la ñe, la r. Now, when I spoke to some of my friends at school, back in my home country, they say those letters don't exist anymore. Do you know anything about that, and why is the reason for that?
Well, because it's convention. You have a similar thing in French. But remember, these languages, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, essentially are all derivative chiefly from the Italian language. They were spread because the Roman soldiers were largely spoke Italian, not Latin. But since the society of Rome was a Latin power, that technical terms peculiar to Rome were introduced into the Italian speech of the people. So when the Roman soldier had completed his assigned term of military service, he went into retirement. And by Roman tradition, though this changed later on, he was given a farm on which to live out the rest of his life. So that Roman soldiers who served in France and served in the Iberian Peninsula lived there, and the Spanish language of, or the Portuguese language, the Iberian languages, were basically a reflection of the Italian. As a matter of fact, in France, the French spoken, pre-Parisian French, which is a fairly late development, in southern France and in the countryside, were vastly dialects of Italian and were spoken as Italian. It was a process in the urbanization from Paris in which the French language acquired those characteristics generally used, which are generally used today. The dialects still to some degree exist. Now, but prior to the Roman soldiers and later, you had several influences which were not Italian acting upon Portuguese language on the Spanish language to change it. You had pre-Roman languages, language groups, of which the Basques are an example. You also had, with the various invasions, the influence of the Berbers and the influence of the Islamic culture and the Umayyad culture, so that you had introduced into what became Spanish and Portuguese an effect from pre-Italian languages, and also from later influences such as the Arabic, which came in. So therefore, what tends to happen, as happened in France, is there was a tendency to homogenize languages, and as has happened in the United States, we have actually, in terms of our use of the English language, we've become increasingly stupid. That is, people who will go to who graduate from universities today, or who study the New York Times style book, are not as intelligent as people who had the same level of education, shall we say, several generations ago. People today, baby boomer generation, are less intelligent than educated people from my generation, and so forth and so on. So but there's been a tendency to simplify languages, to eliminate those factors which were used as irony or the poetic factors. For example, look at poetry. You take classical poetry in Spanish or French or Italian, and you find that it actually is richer than any contemporary poetry in those languages. You will find that certain things that make them richer is the ability to express ideas, particularly ironically, in a way which cannot be expressed in or at least simply in the use of the modern language. So therefore, those things which in the language which were used at an earlier time as recognized artifacts of the language to help convey irony, that is, to generate ideas, these things have tended to be sort of, should we say, debrided. They've got a haircut, and you can't see the golden flowing locks anymore, because the guy has shaved his head and there's no hair visible. So that's what's happened. So there is actually a change in the language, which is somewhat natural, but there's also an increase of stupidity factor as a result of the modernism, the influence of modernization of the use of language. Some of this is better, but most of it is worse.
Yeah, Matt, come on up. Okay, you'll be next.
Hi, Lynn. My name is Matthew. I'm from the L.A. office. I said, this is Matthew from the L.A. office. Yeah. And I had a question about the economic collapse, and I was just wondering exactly what type of factors or events could cause the final stage of the collapse to occur.
Not events. Events won't do it. Let's look at things realistically. Realistically, since the period 1964 to 1972, there has been a moral and physical degeneration in the U.S. economy. Since 1972 to 1981, this degeneration accelerated and accelerated internationally through the new floating exchange rate monetary system. In 1979, Paul Volcker introduced deregulation, but destroyed much of our economy. In 1987, immediately after the collapse of the New York stock market in October 1987, in came Greenspan, who introduced derivatives, and the economy has been destroyed still more. In the process, we have shipped most of the jobs in the United States outside the United States into cheap labor abroad. We have lost much of our infrastructure. The standard of living, relatively speaking, of most Americans, especially those in the lower 80% of family income brackets, is poorer than it was 20 years ago. So already we have a collapse in process. Now we've reached the point that this cannot go on. The process is being postponed slightly by very imaginative times of the types of fakery. But we're on the edge of an actual collapse. So it is not some factor that's going to cause the collapse. The collapse is inevitable because the system is like a balloon which is overstretched, which is going to pop. Nothing will prevent it from popping. The question is, what do we do after it pops? So you don't have to look for an event to account for what might or might not happen. Anything will happen. Somebody sneezes at it, it can blow up. We're on the verge, it's inevitable. We're in a period of months. But it could happen tomorrow, could happen next week, could happen a month from now, could happen 4 months from now. But we're in a process in which the blowout, the absolute blowout of the present world monetary financial system and an economic collapse, which probably will collapse the economy in the short term by as much as 50% below its present level, will occur. That is inevitable unless we introduce a new factor, which is my election as president. Then we would change. But without my election as president or some related comparable phenomenon, this thing is all the way down already. No new development is needed to collapse it.
Lynn, this is Harley. Can you take one or two more, or you want to call it? Okay, one or two more, but they have to be bel canto, okay? Anyone want to risk their bel canto speaking? All right, we've got someone. Okay.
Hello, Lynn, this is Nick from L.A. Hi, how are you? Great. I have two questions. One is, what is Leibniz talking about with his pre-established harmony, where he says that the domain of final causes don't directly affect the body, or the soul doesn't directly influence the body, and the body doesn't directly influence the soul? How do they relate? And secondly, if you can answer, concerning people like Dante, how does the imagination necessary for classical art, like the development of morality? Maybe you can just take, yeah, those are the two questions.
Take them in reverse order to get them right, but after Dante came before Leibniz. The issue here, the imagination is not a fantastic world. It may appear to be fantastic to people who don't understand it, but a sound imagination never is closer to reality than sense perception. Because, for example, every existing known universal physical principle exists as an object of the mind only in the imagination. That what appears as sense perception is flawed and largely untrue. However, there's a connection between the two which leads to harmony. The connection is the human mind's creative powers. When take the case of common example, that Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation. If two things were crucial. One fact. First, the observed orbit was elliptical, and that the orbit's speed, the movement around the orbit, was in the ratio determined of equal areas, equal times. These are two anomalies. All right. Now, another one. Then you had this looping, apparent looping, of the Mars orbit at certain times in the relationship between Earth and Mars. Just looped back on itself. Seemed to go backwards. These two things taken into account shows that there was a principle operating in the solar system which did not correspond to simply mapping sense experience. This meant discovering that principle. Now, he called it in the English translation an intention, which is another word for a principle that I've dealt with in writing on this thing. So that is the harmony. We, the human mind, by discovering, as Kepler discovered universal gravitation, we discover the connection, the efficient connection, between the illusory, which is sense perception, the mere shadow of reality, with distortions in it. We are able to look beyond the distortions of sense perception to see the principles, unseen principles, in the imagination, which are the forces which actually control what happens in the sense perceptual world. Therefore, the harmony. The harmony is established by the human mind. The harmony is located in the imagination. The imagination is controlled by the principle of truth. That is, you cannot imagine things and hold to them to be valid unless you can prove them to be efficiently true.
right, Lynn, I think we're going to let you go, and we're going to do some work on some bel canto here.
Well, yeah, that, you know, avoid the bel canto.
Okay. All right, we got that.
Have fun.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, we need at least a 20-minute break.
Wait, I have a short announcement.
Okay, go ahead.